Recently, you guys have partnered up with Scotty Barnes.
He wanted to buy a place there. He was coming in as our prototypical resident, saying like, this is the spot the guys like him are gonna live. And you start to figure out what the brand identity for the project is. There's 344 cranes in the sky in Toronto right now. You got a lot of competition.
I think a lot of people are gonna tap into this one and see what you have to say.
You know, a ton of leverage, lots of debt. I was young and I'm like, what's gonna happen? I'm gonna lose what I have. One of our sites, I have to move a 4 million pound heritage building that no one's ever done before. So I need about $500 million of equity. These projects are so big that all five major Canadian banks pooled together for every one of these projects. Wow.
I really struggle to believe that you can achieve balance when you're after something so big.
So much of what we do every day is just going. Yeah. You don't need to have that experience and that wisdom for every little decision.
Welcome back to the MBH podcast, Money Buys Happiness. Guys, first and foremost, love you guys for tapping in, okay? Hit the subscribe button if you're not subscribed. Like the video, leave a comment, show us some love. What else? I know there's so many things
merch,
you want to get through.
Merch coming.
Yeah, I know. Get through it. Let's go.
Follow the Snapchat at the MBH podcast. Exclusive content there. And give a follow to our other shows. They're all killing it. Girls Next Door, check them out. Catamania, check them out. Price to Sell, check them out.
Yes.
There's more, but we'll stop there. We're back in Toronto, though. The boys are back.
Finally.
All right. We got a very impressive guest with us today. Yes. Successful entrepreneur who has made a name for himself in real estate development with a portfolio worth billions. Look at that.
I love the B word.
How you doing, man?
Good, guys. How are you?
Thanks for having us in this lovely showroom.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here, too.
Of course.
Glad you guys come in today.
I think our audience is going to get a lot of value from this. I don't think we've ever interviewed a real estate developer.
No, first time.
You're going to be the first. I know a lot of people that watch us are into real estate. And, you know, a lot of our audience are go-getters, money guys. So I think a lot of people are going to tap into this one and see what you have to say. But for anyone maybe that doesn't know who you are or what you do, give us a little introduction.
For sure. So I'm the co-founder and CEO of Originate Developments. We're a Toronto-focused infill firm, and what that means is we build in the heart of the city, okay, in places where there's already buildings, where there's subways, primarily high-rise.
Okay.
We've got some 60-plus story buildings in the pipeline now, and that's our focus. Good locations, you know, in Toronto specifically.
You guys go to the hectic locations,
in
the heart of it all, right?
Yeah.
And I was watching one of your pods just to kind of start with this topic, but you kind of assemble lots at times.
For sure.
Right? So maybe one plot of land was originally 13, 14 pieces.
Yeah.
So talk to us about that a little bit before we get into it. Because I thought that was super interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I know you guys talk a lot about what it's like starting these businesses and what the hustle's like. And like when I started Originate, you know, I looked around and said, okay, I know the CEOs of these other companies are smarter than me, more experienced. What can I do? Mm-hmm. And you had to chase the deal. So we did a lot of assemblies. There's a project we have at Jarvis and Bloor that's 13 pieces. 12 of them were homeowners. Like it was like their primary residence. So it was a really emotional decision for them. It was a process. Like it wasn't like a, you know, another business deal where it's just about the dollars.
Yes.
Yeah. You gotta go in and convince them like, hey, this is gonna be good for the city, you know, whatever the case may be.
Well, it's also gotta be good for them, right? And you gotta figure out what drives them. One family were Ukrainian immigrants. This is the beginning of the Ukraine war. And they had family coming and staying with them. And they were saying, we gotta make sure we have a place, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Like who knows who's coming.
So that's been happening a lot. Like you have to get multiple pieces of...
Totally. It's rare to see. These downtown parking lots are done, right?
Yeah,
that's where everyone starts now.
True.
And how are you getting them? Are you offering them a price that they can't say no to?
Yeah. I mean, it's not just the price, right?
Yeah.
Like sometimes people get scared when you offer them too much money. So the money's got to be a thing. They've got to be making money doing it.
Okay.
But I think you got to hold their hand through the process. The way we did that one was they got a good price. We also gave them, you know, a quick closing and the ability to stay for a while. And we said, listen, we're giving you a realtor who's going to work with you and help you find a place, but we're buying you a lot of time. So you're going to be able to stretch that dollar.
Cool.
And it's not just the money you're making. It's that you got a place to stay for a while. It's free. And we're going to help you find that next place. And that's how you're going to grow.
So also making it convenient for them.
Totally.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about Originate. How did it come to be? How did you get into it? Did you think you would be in this space?
No way.
Like walk us through it.
And how old is it, by the way?
So I started Originate 6 years ago.
Okay, cool.
With my partner, Daryl. Man, it was totally lucky. Mm-hmm. So in university, I was putting myself through school and I started working for this guy, sold flowers at university graduations.
Okay.
It's such a weird niche. Like he's an engineer. Like it was a summer like side hustle. Mm-hmm. He graduated school and is like, I'm making enough money selling flowers that I'm not going to be an engineer.
All right.
So this is a great summer job. I drive all over the states in like a budget truck, like nice. Staying in like motels. That's back in the day when like you could still smoke in motels. Oh, like you come out and like, it was such a fun summer job. Mm-hmm. It was such a great way to learn business, you know, mm-hmm. setting up, finding local staff and doing, you know, tens of thousands of dollars of sales in 24 hours, moving on to the next town. It was a really fun gig.
Yeah.
And I came to work for him after school. I never thought I would do something like that, but it was just, I loved it.
Yeah.
Like I loved the hustle and I'm like, I don't really care what I'm doing. I don't care to tell people that I'm doing something fancy or like I just had so much fun and we were making good money. Mm-hmm. And my partner, Daryl, who at the time was my boss, he's now my partner.
Cool.
He was taking the money he made and investing in student housing.
Okay.
Buying a $300,000 student house, adding a few bedrooms, going to the bank and getting it valued a little higher and using that money to buy the next one. Mm. And he built this really great portfolio all on his own of student houses. And eventually the bank said, listen, man, like you're a commercial landlord, right? We're going to treat you like you own an apartment. You just own an apartment with 25 addresses.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't sustainable anymore. And he got into building, now runs out west what's probably the biggest high-rise developer west of Mississauga called Innate Developments.
Okay.
And I learned a lot working for him. And I just wasn't smart enough to know, you know, what was too risky for me, like what I shouldn't be doing. So I started following in his footsteps and buying things with, you know, a ton of leverage, lots of debt. You know, I was young and I'm like, what's going to happen? I'm going to lose what I have. Like, cool.
Sure. Yeah. All right.
I'm in my 20s. I don't have a family. Like what's going to go wrong here?
Yeah.
I got a salary and that pays my rent and like, I'm good. So I really ran with it and I pushed it pretty hard.
Okay.
And then I found a few development opportunities that were small. You know, I'd started like renovating triplexes or building a house, stuff that was manageable. Mm-hmm. And as it got a little bigger, my then boss at the time, Daryl, said, listen, whatever you want to do, I'm happy to invest with you. I believe in you. He's someone that's really believed in people his whole career. And
okay.
just a great human being. Mm-hmm. And he gave me that opportunity. And mm-hmm. he had some incredible partners that were investing in his deals. And that kind of came over here. And I was juggling both for a while. And there was this breaking point. It's not that I was trying to go into development. I was in Texas and California selling flowers and t-shirts and doing our graduation thing. And it's like being a camp counselor. It wasn't just the grind. I had like 50 kids with me in a hotel room and like there's no break.
Oh, wow.
Like my now wife, then girlfriend, I didn't have time to call her because I'm like, I'm taking the kids out for dinner. Like I'm taking them out tonight, making sure that like they don't do anything crazy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, guys, I can't touch these projects for like 2 months. Like I don't have a second. I need 2 months off and I'm back in July and I'm on it.
Okay.
And it was kind of that breaking point where I'm like, how can I be doing these big, you know, multi-million-dollar deals and say like, I just wait 2 months.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's kind of when I had to start transitioning. And over the course of a year, I sold my shares in that business. I'd become an equity partner and moved over full time to doing this. And,
okay.
And it was scary. I'm like, I remember talking to friends of mine and I'm like, am I going to be able to find enough deals? Is this going to be a real business or am I just, you know, trying to turn it into something? And they came, like we hunted things down and found, you know, one great site every year and really grew it.
So you were doing your own properties for a little bit until you eventually, your now partner came to you, correct? Yeah.
So I had found a bit of a bigger site. I found downtown in the annex, like this house. And I'm like, listen, think I can buy the neighbor. I think I can do 6 townhomes and it's a little bigger than what I've done before. And he's like, I'm in, let's do it.
Yeah.
And then I found something around the corner that was a 40-50 unit project. And I'm like, what do you think? Like there's some downside protection. And that's kind of how we started on this smaller stuff.
Okay.
And really quickly, I learned that was a terrible business. Like you can't do, I think it's like a lot of businesses. You can do things that are really small where it's just you and you have control and you can make real money and you can do things that are really big. Mm-hmm. But being stuck in that in between, you have to deal with all the red tape the big guys deal with, but you don't have that scale. Something goes wrong and you know, this is a $10 million project instead of a $500 million project. You can't absorb that.
Yes.
And that's how we grew our scale really quickly from those first few projects were, you know, $10 million projects. And now the smallest project we bought in 3 years is like $650 million. Like they're getting much bigger.
It's a big jump. And, I'm curious though, in terms of like making that jump from the smaller projects and now moving into 10 million, 60, 650 and all that, you had a mentor, I guess, which is your business partner, Daryl as well. Walk us through that. I'm curious. Cause I know like, you know, on Instagram, everyone wants to be either a realtor, they want to get into development, they want to do this whole thing. But I understand a little bit that it's got to be tough to some extent. Like you're speaking about red tape, you're talking about permits, and with the city council, and you got to get things changed to make things work. For somebody that is interested in doing this, how important is it to have a partner or a mentor that's sort of done it already And how would you suggest someone finds that person or gets involved?
Yeah. I mean, listen, on the technical side, you can always learn stuff like that. I think the reason you need a partner is because this is a crazy business and you're talking huge numbers and you need that sounding board. Mm-hmm. You need a smart person there that you're making your decisions with every day saying like, you know, does this make sense? Mm-hmm. The rest of it, you can hire someone, you know, or you Fair. Can, you read a book. Like there's a lot of learning I did along the way. And the most important stuff is the big picture stuff that would, you know, translate to any business. Mm-hmm. The real estate specific stuff, I could have always hired someone if I hadn't learned that skill set.
True.
But I think it's just super important to have that. And there's so many different things you got to bring to the table to do things this big, right? You need to be able to look people in the eye and say, I can do this and here's why. And I think for one person to do that solo is hard. Mm-hmm. I think you need a couple people with different angles to get there. How to get started? Fuck, that's a hard question. I was super lucky that I had this guy who I'd started working for when I was 18, eventually became a minority partner in another business who got to watch me grow up and, you know, really know me. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was able to jump the line so quickly.
True.
But I think it's the same thing for any young hustler out there. Like, find someone established, come and bring them value, which is what I did, right? I'm like, I found sites. I've got the time. Let's do this together. If anyone calls me up tomorrow and says, I've got a great site and I want to put in the grind and I'm okay to be a small, you know, fish in this one, like, I think that's how,
yeah,
that's how I get excited about bringing someone in and mentoring them. And I think that's how you grow.
So is that the kind of value you were bringing to your partner? Because that was my next question, is what value do you think he saw in you? Because he was already successful doing it. So what do you think he saw in you at that time?
I mean, I think he saw the hours. He knew that we thought the same way. Mm-hmm. Like, he'd watched me grind it out with him for a decade and he knew, you know, that I was going to put in the energy. Mm-hmm. And it was the hours.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so much of what we do every day is just going. Yeah. You don't need to have that, you know, that experience and that wisdom for every little decision. True. So he knew he'd be there for the big stuff and that I would make the right decisions on the small stuff.
And I think a lot of people can get involved and start their projects by giving up their sweat equity because, you know, you don't start with money, you don't start with that many skills. So we see that a lot too, where that's the hard part where people say, okay, well, now I'm out. If I got to do all this work and all these hours, now I'm out. But that's your way in, right?
Totally.
What kind of fulfillment were you getting from these projects that wanted you to keep, like, that made you want to keep going? Was it the money? Was it seeing the final product?
Sure.
Yeah.
Listen, it definitely wasn't the money.
Okay.
For the first 2 years, I didn't take a penny out of the company. That was our deal, that I drew a salary, but only when we made money. So we had to be making some money for me to draw the salary.
So you signed up with no salary.
And I walked away from another business. I still, as a salary, I'm drawing less today than I did 6-7 years ago at our other business.
Wow.
Right? You're looking for those big payouts.
Yeah.
And but on top of that, I know this is going to sound like a crazy number. To run this business at scale, let's say solo, without a partner, without financial partners, I need about $500 million of equity. Like, right? So I'm not looking at this saying, I've heard other guys on your podcast talk about this. Like, you know, I really want that car, right? I always wanted whatever. And like, that's my move. And I got 10 M's in the bank and that's what I'm doing. Mm. This is the opposite. This is like, you're in this for the long haul because you love the hustle.
Yeah.
I know that there's no way I'd be happy without that grind. I need to have, you know, that grind to really enjoy life when I'm not grinding.
Yeah.
So that's the goal here, to build this thing out, to keep making it bigger, to keep taking a bigger and bigger stake of these projects and have something that's multi-generational that I can sort of pass down.
So the way that it works then for somebody listening and wants to be in your position is like, from a salary perspective, it's nothing crazy. It's once the project closes and finishes and it's built and everyone's kind of moved in, that's where you're seeing your sort of bigger payouts.
And I'll tell you why. And I think this is like any other business where you've got investors. There's two sides to this. There's the owning the equity of the project, which I always want to own as much as I can. And then there's the fact that I'm the manager and we're drawing a fee from the project from the investors, you know, to manage it. And I think the reason we've been able to scale so quickly, Daryl did this at his other business and we're doing it here, is that we're saying to people, A, we have a ton of skin in the game. We're putting every dollar we have in. And B, we're not looking to draw these big fees early on. That's something that comes at the end. We do a good job. The fee comes out because we got to pay our staff. Mm-hmm. But that's what lets someone see that we're value aligned.
Okay.
And I think I've seen this in a lot of startups, not just real estate, where you're drawing a really big management fee. And someone says, does this person really care how things go? Do they care if the product goes well? Right?
Guaranteed the money. Yep.
Totally. And that makes it a lot harder to sell someone. But I've been able to sit in a room with people and say, listen, I only make money at the end. I only make money if this goes great. I am totally vested and I really need this, right? I'm putting everything I have in here. Like, I need this.
Yeah.
And I think that's also how you get someone to buy into your vision.
Well, yeah, as an investor, like you're saying, hey, I want the biggest equity stake. Like, I want to hold this thing right to the end.
Totally. Taking all the risk, really.
Yeah. If I'm putting money into a business like that, that's exactly what I want to hear from the guy who's leading the project.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And no. you got to know they need it, right? Any entrepreneur I've ever invested in, you got to know that they need it so bad.
Yeah.
They're willing to do whatever it takes. And I think that's the culture we created here.
Yeah. And even when it comes to, I guess, because you guys do a lot of raising capital as well, right?
Yeah.
Getting money from investors, bringing projects to life. And this is something that, you know, even Anthony and I are on personal levels, business levels, have been pitching a lot of our businesses to investors, right? And a lot of our audience does that as well. They create businesses and they want to exit, or they want to pitch a special project. So over the years of you pitching these projects and working with investors, what have you learned? What are some key things that you've learned, let's say, when pitching an investor of your project, and how do you get them to believe in you?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the places I've been lucky that maybe not everybody is that the product's always been pretty straightforward. So okay. The pitch has always been me, right? Mm-hmm. If I buy something and a good location in Toronto, everybody who's a Toronto real estate person gets it. Mm-hmm. I don't have to pitch you on the project. I just have to pitch you on the me. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to be really genuine and honest. I've heard a million of these pitches and sometimes they're not genuine, right? I exited this business. I made a whole bunch of money. I'm incredible. Like, I'm starting another one. And by the way, I'm putting in very little of my own money. Will you guys write checks?
So red flag. Right? Like, red flag. Like, yeah.
I was able to give a pretty genuine pitch of, and I said it to you guys before, I know I'm not the most experienced, but I'm doing the job 3-4 rungs below the CEO in any other company. Mm-hmm. And I'm putting in that energy and I need this more than anyone else needs it. And I think that's resonated with people.
Just being
honest. They get it and they see it. And we've picked up a lot of projects specifically where I've been able to say, look, this is where the sweat equity is going to add value versus another site. There's a problem here. It can be fixed with sweat. Okay. Like, this is what I'm doing. And people get it.
Yeah.
And you can show how you're creating that value. And I think I needed that for a long time. I think we're a little bit past that now. But for a while, I had to show people that it's the sweat that's really creating the value here.
True.
And I want to know, running off of that, I want to know, what was the first, like, big project where you go, okay, like, this is legit now. You know what I mean? I'm here to make a mark. This is a building or a project or a group of townhomes that's like, it's putting us on the map to some extent that at least maybe the big boys have to start, you know, understanding that we're here to play now too.
Yeah, totally. I think it's the one that's sitting behind me right now in the boardroom.
Cool.
At Bayview and Shepherd, called 699.
Okay.
Which, good location in Toronto, like in North York, right next to a subway station.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was our first condo project that we launched in the city and kind of the first time that people had heard of us.
Okay.
And it was a great start. Like, it's going really well. We're about a year and a half away from construction. Mm-hmm. Like, I think we're creating a really cool product there and it's going to help build that brand moving forward.
And for anybody that wants to understand the business side of it, what does an investment in a project like that look like? What do you guys have to fork out money wise and maybe years and hours and all of that to get to, you said it's under construction currently.
Yeah. So we closed on that site in January 2019. So we bought it a little bit before that. This was a smaller project.
Okay.
So the investment in this was about $10 million.
Okay.
Versus some of ours now that are $60, $70 million.
Okay.
And that's going to close at the end of 2025.
Yeah.
So we're talking about, you know, a 6-year horizon there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fast. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are longer than that. So this was, we started in 2018, found the site, did the due diligence, closed in 2019, and got into the ground in late 2022.
And then, so you're carrying that whole time and you're going through sales.
Yeah.
So maybe walk us through that a little bit so people understand sort of the process of, like, from when you close on a site all the way to the finish point.
Totally. So, I mean, you really start with a vision, right? And I think people think this is way more technical than it is. It's just, it's horse trading and not taking no for an answer. Mm-hmm. You sit down with the city and no one's ever going to like what you want to do, right? You're always pushing the envelope. You always want to do a little bit more, mm-hmm. especially being a young guy, right? You're straying from convention a little bit, doing things differently. And you fight through that for years.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our projects have been quick. It's been a year, but it's often 2 or 3 years of just sort of fighting through every little detail. Damn. What's tough in Toronto that might not be the case in other cities is it's really disjointed. I'm not talking to one guy who's across the table. There's a million people that I'm trying to make happy, and there's no one that's sort of your champion there. That's what makes it so hard, that I've got to negotiate between different bodies in the city and neighborhood associations and whatever, and find something that makes economic sense while we're doing that, because people are asking for a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that's your pitch, right? What are you selling? Like, what do I want to gain out of this? What do I want to end up with? And you have to figure out what you're selling, and it just becomes straight horse trading.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get there and you kind of have your certainty in that handshake deal, you keep working through permitting, which is a headache, and a lot of other stuff, but that's pretty formulaic.
Mm-hmm.
And you start to figure out what the brand identity for the project is. How am I going to market this? There's 344 cranes in the sky in Toronto right now. You got a lot of competition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why are you buying my project instead of someone else's?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, in today's market being a really tough market, and that's the most important thing that we can focus on.
Yeah.
Like how we get people to believe in us and believe in this condo and want to be a part of it.
Well, your why compared to everyone else, right? Which, what is your why? When they asked the difference between you and other developers,
totally.
What's your
answer? I mean, I think I can tell you the originate answer, but it's also about the building because people don't really care about us, right?
True.
They care about the building. And I think it's just about being totally honest. Okay. Condos in Toronto have been selling this like sexy champagne lifestyle, which is bullshit, right? Right? We're not in Miami. I was just in Miami and I'm like, people are going, I want to fucking live here. And like they're picking condos over anything else. They want to live in Brickell. They want to live wherever.
Yep.
That's not exactly the case here. Mm-hmm. You're looking at a city where people that live in condos are either wealthy downsizers, they can't afford a home, or they're a renter.
Yeah.
So I think you have to have a really honest marketing campaign to attract real people mm-hmm. and not just make it look sexy.
True.
So each brand's a little different. You're going after different people.
Okay.
The launch we have going on now at Bathurst and Richmond, like we're going for end user King West people that know that neighborhood. We're creating a lifestyle brand there, and we know what we're targeting. Mm-hmm. Our next product's a real investor driven, you know, 800 unit condo, and you've got to know who you're going after there too. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it just has to be a logical sales pitch. It can't always be as sexy as we want to make it, like with these crazy videos. Like you got to just be honest.
True.
And I think that's the difference. Like it's the difference, I think, for us as a company.
Yeah.
We're just trying to be a little bit more forthright with what we're doing and why, and I think that it resonates with people.
And what would you say your role is within all these projects?
Until 18 months ago, the company was me plus one person.
Wow.
So, I mean, we've been growing and growing slowly because I want to find the right people, but I'm still hands-on in everything. And I've got amazing people here that I really trust, but still super hands-on with every part of it.
What's the team at right now? How many people?
Me plus six.
Nice.
So seven. We're tight. We'll be about 30 in 2 years and building out our construction division. So that's going to be a slow process, but we'll be, you know, adding 25 people almost in the next 2 years.
Okay.
And I kind of started with the captains. Like I've got all the people that are going to be the VPs that are going to be running the departments. Okay. And I wanted the people that like, you know, like me, like want to be high level thinkers, but also love getting in the weeds and love the grind. Mm-hmm.
So currently, like are any of your employees or people that are on the team, are you ever interested in bringing them on as partners?
It's a good question. It's not really something that's come up yet. I think we're too young of a business
to start
thinking about that, but I hear you.
Yeah. I wonder, cause I think like when I think of, development companies, I think of like, you know, law firms and things like that. There's always like the sort of people who have put the sweat equity in and then the hustle, and then they kind of move into that. So I'm thinking, do you see that for yourself in the future and for the business?
I think
in the
it's
future?
A space more where you see more profit share because you want to incentivize people and you want to make them feel like part of the team. I think the ownership part's tricky because it's not just about putting in the sweat equity, and this is where people feel like they're giving up a lot. It's still going to the bank and taking out a $500 million loan and signing your name on it, right? Yeah. And I think that's what gets tricky in this business. Like, whose name is really on the line?
Fair.
Like, are you a partner if you're not taking that risk? And do I want my employees taking that risk that if a project goes bad, they're going down with it?
Too.
Fair. Yeah. And I think that's kind of why you don't see it as often. Mm-hmm. In a law firm, you don't have that risk, right?
Yes.
Business could lose a little money this year, probably won't.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
Here, a project can lose $100 million. And like, do I really want my employees to feel that?
Yeah. 100%. At that point, profit share makes more sense.
Yeah.
It's less risk.
Yeah.
So are you like the team leader, you would say, here?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, listen, I've got a team that is really independent. I hire people that are real self-starters.
Okay.
That like are going to be the captains to run this business. But yeah, for
sure. Well, that's what I wanted to ask. How you get this team to buy in? Is it compensating them well? Is it incentivizing them? Because we run a few teams too, and we're always trying to, you know, up our game, step our game up, and make sure that everyone around us is happy to be here, happy to be part of the culture.
I don't think it's the money. I think people have to earn fair salaries, but I don't think if I bumped everyone's salary 20 points tomorrow, they'd be happier people and better employees.
Okay.
I
think they
got to
feel good about what they're making, but no. I mean, first of all, especially having a small team, I know everyone, I know what they want, I know what makes them tick, and I know how to manage them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I hired people that really don't need that level of management, and that's what I was going for.
Okay.
I want it to feel like a collaboration. That's what I learned from my partner. You know, when I was an 18-year-old kid working for him and he was already, you know, really successful and on his way, as a young guy, like he treated me like I was his partner. He was generous. He was honest. And that's what I've tried to do here. Like, I don't want people feeling like the buck stops with me and I make a decision and like put it on my desk and I sign the paper.
Yeah.
I want everyone to feel like they own their shit.
Okay.
And I think about that a lot. Listen, there's times my staff make decisions I might not agree with and I stay out of it and say, listen, I want them to own it. They probably don't agree with all of my decisions. Like, I believe in them. Let's let them go.
Yeah.
And I think that's what gets them motivated and excited every day.
Of course. Well, they want some sort of their own authority, you know, at the end of the day to make decisions.
Makes them feel like it's their business. That's how I felt working for my partner. Every day I treated his money like my money, and I felt like it was my business, and I was proud.
Yeah.
And that's how I want people to feel here.
Yeah, that's such a like big heated debate I think we've had with other partners and things like that, is it's not all about the money. Because you're right. I feel like, okay, so you give someone an extra $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 annually on their salary, that's not going to make them work harder. They want to feel like they're a part of the business and the decisions they're making actually hold weight, right? They're and especially in a business like this, I can imagine. So yeah, I totally agree with you. I think you got to make them feel really a part of something, right? The bigger picture, the bigger vision.
So, yeah, you could do that too without bringing them in as a partner on equity too, right? You just got to give them that freedom.
Totally.
But I could imagine for you it must be stressful sometimes because the decisions they're probably making are huge.
They're really big. But listen, I know this is a weird analogy, but at that business, that flower business, what we were really doing was it was running university retail. Okay. So we'd set up at the University of Texas at 10 venues with 50 staff and bang out six figures of sales on small items in like 24 hours.
Okay.
And I found our staff that really believed in themselves, that had a vision that said, this is how I do it. Even if I didn't agree with their vision and I did it differently, they were the most successful. So I look for people like that, that believe in themselves and say, this is the right way to go.
True.
Because we really don't know. When we're planning a project, we really don't know what the right unit mix is, what the right sizes are, what the right amenities are. But I need someone that believes in themselves and sees that vision all the way through so it's cohesive. Yes. And I think that's how you're successful.
True.
I want to go back a little bit to the brand. You were mentioning how sort of every building has its own brand. So I know recently you guys have partnered up with Scotty Barnes. I want to talk about that a little bit because
it's massive.
I don't think I've really seen anything similar to it in the city. Mm-hmm. I may be wrong. Correct me if I'm wrong, but walk us through that sort of collaboration, why it works and where you think the value is in that.
Sure. I think with any of these things, and I've seen a few others, some have been really good and some haven't. It's about honesty in the brand. And the way this started was that we said, we want to take the commercial space in this building and we want it to help draw people in because it shows them the lifestyle they're going to have, they're going to lead living here. Mm-hmm. So we found these partners to run the space, Patrick and Adam Marzouk, who ran the regulars, you know, just down the street at Bathurst and King for a long time.
Those are our guys.
They're great guys.
Yep.
And we were talking to them about the idea and they came back with an incredible concept for a restaurant there. They're calling Grocery. So you come in, it's a regular restaurant for anyone in the community, but if you live there and you're like, I love that meal, they'll pack up the ingredients and you take it to the 4,000 square foot rooftop when you have friends over and you're like, oh, cool. We want to do the whatever, the steak chimichurri for eight.
Cool.
They do hot lunches in the co-working space. Like, it's a real integration. So that's what we were hunting down, a partner to really make this, you know, that hospitality experience.
Yep.
And they came up with something incredible. And they're the ones that brought us this opportunity. Like, their buddies with Scotty and said, listen, we were talking about it. He'd love to get involved in the space. He thinks it's really cool. And I'm like, I don't know about a celebrity endorsement, like, just on the face, but he wanted to buy a place there. So the deal we struck with him is that we're giving him a bit of a discount on a place, and it's not like we're giving him a ton of cash to be the brand.
Cool.
So for us, it was genuine, where we're like, this guy would have lived in Yorkville 5 years ago. If you're not a Toronto person, that's kind of like the heart of the city. We're like, the fact that he wants to live here now is what's speaking. Where the other endorsements that I've seen are, this guy did the kitchen, or this guy did the lobby.
Yeah, or like painted this guy, the mural.
Did the design, which is cool.
Yeah.
Like, it's cool, but that's art. And this wasn't about art. Scotty wasn't coming in as this artist. He was coming in as our prototypical resident, saying, like, this is the spot that guys like him are going to live.
Yep.
And as he walked through the building with us and helped us design certain things, it wasn't just his design eye that was coming out. It was him saying, this is how I'd use the space. Oh, we have like a sports simulator room bar, and I'm like, what would you do here? How are you using it? Like, what do you want to see here? And that was kind of the involvement that he had.
So you actually got him involved in like design and
cool.
Well, it's very unique. And he's going to live there, I think, which is the coolest thing. I think that actually speaks volumes to say, like, in a way, from the investor standpoint, like you were saying earlier, like, hey, we want to hold all the equity because we believe in the project. Well, now you have this sort of celebrity athlete endorsement, but he's not just getting paid and saying, yeah, this is awesome, guys, buy it. He's like, I'm going to live here too.
Totally.
Yeah, no, it's unbelievable. Wow, that's unbelievable.
Has it been going well? Like, has that collaboration?
It's been a tough market, but it's definitely helped. And what's interesting is, I think looking at that lifestyle and branding, the units we're selling are and this is rare in Toronto, the bigger, more expensive units to people that saw the brand, get it, get who we are, and get the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. We've been selling less and less investor, smaller units, which is really interesting. It's like kind of against the grain in Toronto.
Yeah. How many units in the building? How many floors?
Building is 18 floors, 229 units.
Nice.
Yeah. And is the affiliation, let's say, with an athlete or a celebrity, something that you can see you bringing to future projects as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just got to be the right endorsement. Like doing a pure investor play, which is what we're doing next, this sort of condo where we know we're selling to people that are going to rent. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the right spot. But we're working on the branding right now for something at Yonge and St. Clair that would target people that really want to live in condos, whether they're downsizers or they just want to be in the middle of the city in that sort of more mature neighborhood. And I think we'll look for the right collaboration there. And it's got to be real, something that's bringing real value to them.
Yeah. And even just kind of to touch on the marketing of the projects, we have a marketing agency as well. So we're always looking to see how businesses are marketing themselves. How have you been able to market in a saturated industry like this or society like this? How have you been able to market? Like, what do you keep in mind when trying to market your projects?
I think you have to have a really clear message because there's so much noise. You're right. It's so saturated. If someone sees the ad and doesn't get the message, you're screwed, right?
Yeah, just so one
it's
time.
Over. Yeah. So you need it to be clear. And then every business has its own cycle. Real estate has a pretty fast cycle of, we want to get these ads out. We do a launch and it's a weird industry. We're like, we advertise more like Coca-Cola. We don't have a call to action.
Okay.
The way this industry works is that there's brokers, because Toronto is such a multicultural city, there's these brokers that are targeting specific ethnic markets and languages that we can't. And that's how a lot of these units get sold.
Okay.
So we're trying to empower those brokers. It's like Coca-Cola trying to empower a store. They don't go out there with a call to action saying, like, go to Coca-Cola.ca and order a case.
Yeah.
They're saying, this is our brand. This is the lifestyle. Look at who we are. Mm-hmm. And you go to another store to buy. So our marketing is targeting not a call to action, but brand awareness.
Nice.
And we're looking for certain moments in time where we know it's going to chain on to what is happening in these smaller ethnic markets as the brokers are advertising. Give them ammo that when you see their ad, you're like, oh yeah, I know those guys.
I've seen them before. Yeah, I've seen them before.
I get it. It's everywhere.
Yeah. So is that, I guess that's speaking to like a certain project, but then also to Originate as well. Like you guys are really trying to build a brand around Originate like a Coca-Cola.
I think we've been doing that through the projects. Like we haven't been putting out our own stuff very much.
Okay.
Which is why it's great to do things like this and talk. And honestly, it gives me ideas talking to people about like how we want to get out there. But it's something we haven't put a lot of focus on. Mm-hmm. Like how do we get our name out there? And I think for a long time, it didn't matter. There wasn't this sort of brand preference that was super strong. Yeah. And in a tougher market, it's going to matter a lot more. We got to get out there and show people who we are. And just like we sold investors on putting money into the project, we now have to sell people who are buying units on like, why us?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's the next step for us.
Of course. Now you have the track record. You have the past projects to show for. Now, sure, it's just brand awareness.
Yeah, totally.
Once someone knows about you, they just want to come to you instead of selling. In terms of the partnership that you have with your partner, what does that look like? How do you guys split roles up? And what do you think makes a great partnership?
So that one's a great partnership because we both do the opposite thing. So I run the day-to-day. Daryl doesn't talk to our staff very often, isn't really here, talks to me 5 times a day.
Okay. Mm.
For me, he's an incredible sounding board. And what he brought was all the things I didn't have, right? He had more capital than I did. He had incredible partnerships with the people that are now our financial partners in these projects. He brought a lot of legitimacy and a lot of big picture stuff. Mm. And I ran the day-to-day. And even though he had experience in another city, you know, in Waterloo and Kitchener and Kingston and Hamilton, and had experience running another business, Toronto is just its own animal. Yeah. That's why I'm so specific about staying in Toronto. I'm like, it's just different than everywhere else. And you got to know every little detail, know who to hunt down, where their parking spot is, what kind of coffee they drink. Like it's a grind.
Yeah.
So I manage that and he's there for all the big picture stuff.
Cool. And he's been the only partner you've ever had.
Yeah. The only partner on Originate. We've been 50-50 since day one and we will be, you know, forever.
Yeah.
And then we have financial partners on every project. We're typically the same people as well.
Nice.
You mentioned something about $650 million. Is that for a specific project?
So there's three projects that we have that we haven't launched yet.
Okay.
Two of them are like $650 million projects. One at Yonge and Sheppard. Sorry, one in Yonge and St. Clair, one at Jarvis and Bloor.
Okay.
And then we have one that's a little bigger than that, two towers. That's close to a $1 billion project.
Wow.
Yeah.
What does that entail exactly? So that's what you guys are fronting to bring this thing to
life.
That's
revenue. That's revenue in these projects.
Total.
Yeah,
okay.
That's revenue.
Okay.
So those three projects are like $2.3, $2.4 billion of revenue.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to speak to that a little bit. I know we spoke sort of off camera, but I think it's incredible. I think it's very interesting. I think a lot of people can learn a lot. Obviously, you hear a number like that, you start to go, wow, these guys are making a lot of money. And but obviously people don't know what goes into that, how much risk you take, how many mouths get fed with that. So I kind of want to walk through that a little bit. $2.4 billion we said between two buildings or two projects.
No, it's three, yeah.
Three projects. So, A, what kind of risk is involved in even being able to say a number like that? Like, let's just start there.
Yeah. So the risk is big. I mean, we've all talked about inflation and costs going up and whatever, which means revenues are going up, but that just means we got to put in more money, right? Mm. There's a certain amount of equity you need in these projects. Minimum's 15%. So when we look at a $1 billion project, it's $150 million investment.
Mm. Yeah.
Sometimes when the market's really good, you know, you're able to count a little bit of the value you've created towards that and get your check a little smaller, but not today where things are a little tighter. Like, for we're sure. just trying to get projects through. We're trying to get things built, and you're not trying to be greedy. So they're big checks, you know, mm-hmm. $100 million on these $650 million projects. They're really big checks. And I think what's scary, if you want to talk about the risk, is obviously, you know, without even getting into sort of catastrophic thinking, you're buying this land, it's really expensive. You've got a huge carrying cost, plus the cost of just running this business of the consultants and the marketing and whatever. And if you can't get through and get the sales you need to be able to get to construction, you're stuck sitting there,
yeah.
like writing another check and another check and another check. And if your profit margin erodes, the bank won't finance you. So that's the real risk in a market like today, that you're not getting to the point that your margin's so slim that the bank won't touch the project and you're stuck.
Wow.
That's why we see some projects that look like they haven't been touched in a while.
And that's also why you hear sometimes about cancellations, where someone went out and sold units and then says, fuck, I can't build the project for a number that makes sense and the bank won't finance it. Because they want to see a pretty big margin to touch you. The bank's taking huge risk.
Yeah.
Just to be clear on this risk, it's not one bank. These projects are so big that all five major Canadian banks pool together for every one of these projects, wow. right?
Really?
They're that big that they're saying you're past our risk factor. So you might have RBC leading it and TD and BMO and Scotia. Everyone's getting in here. So you've got to have all the banks on. Your name's on the line. Like, you're signing for that. Mm-hmm. And they need to see a big enough margin to be willing to take a risk on you, no matter
True.
Who you are.
True.
But as a younger player, like, it's really important.
Of course.
And you were mentioning earlier about how, you know, maybe somebody writes a $10 million check, but someone might also write a $50,000 check.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
I know people don't really understand that there's big players in this game, but also there's people who are just, maybe it's their RSPs or whatever the case may be, that sort of funding a project. So walk us through that. Like, I want to understand how somebody might write you a $10 million check and how someone might write you a $50,000 check.
Yeah. I mean, so we've got a financial partner who's a family, probably the biggest single family investor, and they would write their own checks, right? They come out and write a check. They're called Westdale. They've also got a wing called Harlow Capital, and Harlow raises money from individuals. Like a lot of other companies out there, you know, everyone wants to get a big check because it's how you run that business.
Mm-hmm.
But especially during tough times, you're taking checks in the tens of thousands, and mm-hmm. these are small-time investors. This might be their only real estate investment. Some of these funds are even registered account available, like your RRSP or, you know, your TFSA. So there's people that are writing really small checks. And I've always found that interesting. Like, we look at this thing and say, wow, okay, this is a $1 billion project. These guys have to be making, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's interesting to see where that money goes. How many of the investors are pension funds? How many are small, you know, mom and pops writing $10,000 out of their retirement fund?
Yes.
As this check's gotten bigger, it's a smaller and smaller piece coming from a lot of developers. So I get that I'm sitting here and you're like, okay, this guy's just fucking killing it. And listen, things are going great. That don't take me the wrong way, but there's a lot of mouths to feed in these projects. And it creates wealth for a lot of people. So I've always hated that stigma of like these greedy developers. Like, the number of people invested in every project and the money that gets spread around is big.
But I for me, from the outside looking in, obviously not there, but being a business owner, like, it's just the stress every day. And especially now, I can imagine being in your shoes where, yeah, you are basically taking, you know, investment from people, like you said, and maybe their only real estate investment, 10, 15, 20, whatever, 50,000, whatever your minimum is. Like, that's a lot of pressure to lead a project knowing that, yeah, you have all these mouths to feed. And sure, the family office that writes the $5 million check, they could probably lose it and be okay. But the person to lose their $50,000 check, whatever the case may be, it's a lot of pressure.
Mm-hmm. Especially when there are friends and family. There's not much that keeps me up at night. That's one of the only things that gets me,
especially
during a tougher market, where you just think about those people that are invested in this and are counting on it. You know, they're like, this is going to be how I'm going to buy a home one day. This is going to be my retirement savings.
They're telling
like,
you that directly.
Totally.
Yeah.
And they're saying it excited as they write the check, right? They're like, yeah, I see what I'm getting back here. Yeah. Like, this is my down payment on
and
a
you're
house.
Just,
like,
in
I'm 5 years
like,
on
just
set.
Eyes open, staring at the ceiling.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure a lot of people in your life come to you and they're like, hey, like, next investment, I'm in. Make sure I'm in.
Totally.
Yeah.
And then you think about where you end up down the road with them, right? Like my, we sold a condo at the peak of the market and my brother bought one. He's 8 years younger than me. He's in his 20s and he's like, sick, I'm going to kill it.
Yeah.
Now I'm like looking at the clock and I'm like closing soon. Like feeling I'm closing on this one for you. Like I get it.
Yeah.
It's tough. That's the toughest part.
Of course.
And I think that's why guys say, you know, the bigger the check, the easier it is, right?
Yes. And do you kind of like, do you put it out there that you're taking investment? Like if someone was watching this and they wanted to invest in one of your projects, would they be able to?
It's funny. I don't, just because we're like trying to like, I don't want my friends and family investing anymore. I'm like, as much as I believe in us, I'm like, I just don't want those calls where someone knows
Listen, everything's a risk at the end of the day, right? And people putting in money too, they know that there's a risk associated. Nothing's 100%.
Yeah.
Right. But I'm just asking because I know, like I said, we have some go-getters out there. They're probably like, yo, if this guy's got a track record like that, I'm going to throw it down next time.
Yeah, listen, send me a message. Like, we got a list of people for the next project we're looking at. Cool. Well, you'll put out our contact info. Like,
beautiful.
For sure.
Yeah. And how many projects do you guys currently have on the go right now?
So we have 5 condo projects and 1 apartment on the go right now. 6. Wow.
And so what's your day-to-day look like with that?
Man, it's the best. Like I love it.
But how much you working? You putting in like 12-hour days?
Yeah. Listen, one thing we didn't talk about much, like, the other thing that I find hard, the other thing that keeps me up at night is like the time I'm splitting between my family.
That's what I wanted to bring up.
Like, yeah. It's such a bad culture. Like I run out of here at 5 o'clock every day and I turn to my staff and I'm like, don't take this as like a, we're done at 5. I get home at 5:30, put my kids to bed. They're out by 7 and I'm back to work every night. So for sure, putting in 12-hour days, but I'm splitting it. Yeah. That's where I feel FOMO. Like I don't feel FOMO when I miss like a boys golfing trip. I'm like, it's fine. There'll be another one. Yeah. It's the family. Like it's really hard to feel like, listen, I didn't grow up with like a dad in the house. I was raised by a single mom.
Okay.
And I'm like, I want to be the exact opposite. Mm. And that balance is so tough. Like leaving the team working here.
Yeah.
Like,
well, how old are your kids?
My kids are 1 and 3.
Brand new dad, right?
Yeah,
so
I know.
You started this company before you had them.
Yeah.
So how has that changed the way that you're working now?
Huge. I also started this company before I had an office, right? This was run out of my house. So the two, like my life was the same. Mm-hmm. We opened this office like 1.5 years ago.
Okay.
For a long time, I was just working from home, driving around, going to meetings. And like my life felt, you know, pretty seamless.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's going to the office that I felt that pull. Like the reason I was in Miami last week is because the kids were there. My wife had, you know, the week off. And I'm like, it's hard to work from there, but like I cannot be with the family. It is such a pull. Like I wouldn't trade it for anything, but it's tough.
But it's obviously a work in progress, learning how to balance those things. What have you learned, and was the balance always as good as it is now?
I've always loved both parts, but it's always been hard. It's never been harder than it is now, frankly, as my kids get a little older and want more attention or doing more stuff. Like I want to be there. Mm-hmm. And I'm just not at that stage of maturity as a business, right? My wife says, well, can't you just hire someone to like do some of that shit? And I'm like, listen, I have great people, but like this is the value I'm bringing still, that I'm grinding it out and I'm there. Yep. Like I'm just not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's where I want to be. Like I want to be in both places. I want to be grinding out with the kids and doing it here too.
Yeah. I think we talk about balance a lot, and I was just on a show the other day too. They asked me, you know, what do you think balance means, right? And I really struggle to believe that you can achieve balance when you're after something so big, you know? And I think a lot of the people that we look up to nowadays is successful people like yourself. There was 5-10 years where there was no balance, right? Do you agree with that?
100%. It's funny. The stresses that I feel, I was saying the investor thing, the other thing that really gets me, which it's funny, and like people don't get it unless they're in it, is like anytime I do anything that like I'm breaking away, like I'm hanging out with my buddies, the guilt that I feel, like, I should be working. Like,
yes. I think every great entrepreneur feels that though. I think they all feel that.
I have to separate the family stuff and like remind myself how critical that is. But anything else I do that's outside of that, you know, that 5:30 to 7, like that's where I feel that like
it's like tough. It gets you. I feel like once you're like that, you're kind of always going to be like that. Yeah. Like you'll always have that inside of you.
Yeah.
Right.
But you also have to remember, and this is because I've had that similar feeling so many times where it's like, yeah, you want to go hang out with the guys, chill with the guys, whatever, have a beer, whatever it is. And it's a couple hours, probably, you know, once a month at this point for me. And even when I'm doing it, I'm like, I'm feeling guilty. I'm not even in the moment.
Well, you see a message pop up on your phone. You're like, shit, I got to do this now.
But I think, and this is what I've been trying to tell myself, and I think a lot of people can take a lot from this, is having those moments with the guys, the trip, the night out, whatever the case may be, is actually going to give you a clearer mind the next day. Mm-hmm. Like you're actually going to work better the next day. Mm-hmm. That's my belief. I don't know. Do you agree with that?
100%. I went on like 3 weeks ago. I went on a golf trip with my buddies to Arizona, and I'm like, I'm done with this. I'm not feeling guilty. Like I'm going to be in the moment. And I was, and I got home and I'm like, this is my payback week, right? I'm working till midnight every night at least. Mm-hmm. And I'm on the kids to make sure my wife feels good and like totally worth it. I really feel like I need that yin and yang in my life. Like, I need the struggle so that I really appreciate the good times. True. And that's why I do what I do. That's why I'll always do it. And I 100%, you can't go and like neglect yourself and neglect the things you want to do. Just like accept the punishment later and like smile about it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And even like on a more personal level, I guess, just because, you know, it probably wasn't easy to get where you are today. There was probably moments where you wanted to quit, probably moments where, you know, you second guessed yourself. So during those times, what was life like and how did you get through it?
I don't think I've ever had a moment like that. Like, really? I'm just such an obsessive fuck. I'm like, if this is what I'm doing, like, I'm fucking doing
really?
It.
Really? Like, no times where you're like, you know what? Am I doing the right thing?
Listen,
like,
I also had no safety net. I think jumping into this, walking out of something else that was successful and lucrative was a really hard decision.
Okay.
Because I knew I had something there that I'd been doing for a while. I understood. I could see how it was going to grow.
Yeah.
Like, that was the big risk. And I did it because I wanted to own my time. In that business, I was never going to own my time. It was way too hands-on.
Mm-hmm.
And doing this, like, I knew I had more opportunity to figure out where I was going to be every day and how I could add the most value.
Yeah.
But no, I'm way too obsessive to, no, I don't let doubt like that enter my
did
mind.
Did you feel like, you're locked in on a project and now you're spending less time with family or any moments like that? Because why I'm trying to make a point of it is because a lot of our audiences are younger entrepreneurs, right? Who kind of struggle to find that balance sometimes. And they also struggle to find out, you know, if they're on the right path or if someone has been down that path before. Yeah. Right. So, any sort of moment
know,
at all, but if it's been all rainbows,
I know it's a
dude,
shitty answer. I'm not saying it's, I'm not saying it's rainbows. I'm like, you know what type B fun is? You ever heard that term?
No, I haven't.
It's like climbing a mountain. Like, okay. No one fucking likes it, but you like it at the top, right? Yeah, you're like, that was awesome. But it's miserable the whole time with your 60-pound backpack. I used to be a rock climber. I'm like,
shit.
Okay. You're like, you get it. Like,
yeah.
And that's how I feel.
Okay.
There's tons of times where I'm like, this sucks.
Okay.
But I love the, like, one of the things that I've heard you guys talk about a little bit with entrepreneurs is like the ups and downs and like, I remind myself, like, this too shall pass. Like, I'm here for a reason. Like, I'm not saying it's not hard. I'm not saying at all. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But every moment that I've struggled, I've known why I was there.
Yeah.
And I think that's where staying power comes from. Not everyone feels that way. And that's when you really start second guessing yourself.
Yep.
I feel really good with the decisions I've made and I know I'm where I'm supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter how hard tomorrow is, like, I just feel like I should be there.
But what about in terms of ever second guessing a decision?
Oh yeah, I do that all the time.
Yeah, well, because I think when you become obsessed with whatever it is you're building, you love this thing so much. It's like a child where it's like, you're like, fuck, was that the right, should I have done that? Or should I have done that?
Yeah.
Or how do you deal with that? Because that's something that I'll speak for myself personally. I fucking second guess every decision I make, especially when it comes to the business.
Yeah, you do.
Always. I always, we make a big decision and I go back, I'm like, fuck, should we have done that? And he's like,
I'm already halfway into the whole thing.
He's like, no, dude, we made the decision and we move forward with it no matter what. So I'm curious how you deal with that.
I mean, so I think I'm more like you, and I agree. I usually make a decision to run forward, but especially being in a really tough climate in the last year, you go back and rethink everything, right?
Of course.
Because it's not like you're getting market survey data of what you should be doing. You're just like, this is the vision, and I'm hammering everyone with the vision, and I'm like, this is what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been going back the last few months telling everyone to like, you got to tell me when I'm wrong. You got to tell me when I'm wrong. Like, stop agreeing with me. I want to hear more opinions so that I know we made it by thinking through everything. And if we make a mistake, we make a mistake. There's a girl who's worked for me for about 2 years, Rebecca, and I use her as the example all the time. I'm like, I believe in a bias towards action. Rebecca just goes. She's a pit bull. She's after it every day. And she makes mistakes. And she comes to me and says, listen, I made this mistake. It was a $5,000 mistake, a $10,000 mistake. Like, I feel really shitty. I'm like, what you did the last year, like going, created millions of dollars of value. Yeah. Millions.
Yeah.
Like, you got to just go.
Yep.
So I try to use that to keep myself on track and remember that, like, you know, I don't want to have paralysis by analysis. I got to go.
Yes.
It doesn't mean some decisions don't haunt you later and you say, fuck, like I wish I was smarter.
Yeah.
But I think that's a part of the learning process. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't make it twice. Rebecca never makes the same mistake twice. And like, I try not to either.
Well, that's a good point. I like that you brought up Rebecca. And I think that is, speaks to a bigger thing in terms of like the team and allowing the team to tell you like, hey, I'm wrong. Because a lot of times big decisions, it's just between me and him. And I'm more of like the vision guy. And he's the like head down and just fucking hammers. So it's like I come with a vision. I would say all 90% of the time, he's like, genius, and just goes, right? Where it's like, sometimes it's good to have that person who's like, I don't know about that. You know what I mean? And that's why I think it's important to build the team out, but also build a culture where, like you said, someone who's on the team, quote unquote, is under you in terms of the hierarchy, but they can come to you and say, no, that's a fucking bad idea, or this is why I don't think that's gonna work.
Yeah, you need that. Like, mm-hmm. I don't feel trust with someone. It's like that waiter at the restaurant when you're like, what's good? And they're like, everything. I'm like, fuck off.
Yeah. Bring another guy. You're not the guy.
Yeah. I need someone to tell me often that I'm wrong. And I'm not saying I'm going to listen to them, but I got to hear it. My partner's good at that too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're very different guys. So like, he sees things differently than me and he'll catch that a lot.
But I also feel like you're super humble. Like, you don't really have a strong ego attached to you, which I think every great leader, they need to kind of not have that ego attached, which is what you're talking about.
I think you have to have some sort of ego, right?
There's confidence with it. Yeah.
Like, it's got to, yeah, you're right. Like, your confidence has to come from that. But yeah, so I know where I came from. I know how long I've been here. Like, I know I'm going to be wrong a lot.
Yeah.
My ego is that I want this project to be fucking successful, right?
Yeah.
I want to know I made the right decisions. Like, I don't really care how I got there.
Yeah. And what would you say, let's say moving forward, is the, do you have like one big goal or a certain project you want to do with your company in the years to come?
You know, it's funny in this business is that like we buy these sites and have this stuff going and we build this big portfolio, but the big goal for me, which no one thinks about, is just executing them, right?
Yeah.
Now I have these massive fucking things that I have to do. Okay. One of our sites, I have to like move a 4 million pound heritage building that no one's ever done before and like put it back on top of a parking garage, and we're trying to figure out how the fuck we're gonna do
that. You gotta document that. That's crazy.
Wow.
Like, we have all this cool shit that's like planned on paper. I'm just excited to see it through.
True.
You know. Like, because these are such long projects.
So yeah.
The execution's
what I'm saying. Do you see yourself developing for the rest
forever,
of your life?
Forever, yeah. For sure.
That's what I was going to say. Is there, and maybe it's not for you, but in this business, is there, like, do people exit out of these things?
Yeah, I mean, I think people exit when there's, these businesses, as big as they seem and as much revenue as they make and as much money as they make, like, it's still run by a pretty tight group. So if this doesn't become a multi-generational thing, like, what's your plan?
True.
No one's really, or very few people are interested in saying, I'm just getting some professional managers. And like, that's when we see these companies kind of get disbanded.
Okay.
When you're like, all right, I'm out. Like, I put in my time. There's no one else there. Like,
yes.
You know, I can't let someone I'm hiring for $200,000 a year make these billion-dollar decisions for me.
Of course.
So that's, I think, when things go.
Do you sort of have a chip on your shoulder in the sense of like, you want to come out and be like, hey, we're fucking here type of thing? Like, watch out for us?
I think we're there. I mean, I think that people know that and we're there now. And now I just have to put my head down and prove it. And like, prove to everyone that what I've been saying is true and that this hustle is gonna create value.
Uh-huh.
My wife would remind me all the time when I was doing these projects and buying this stuff. She's like, they know you've built like 2 houses, right? And like, this is a $600 million project. Like, now I'm just
a little
like,
bit
yeah.
of a step up.
So I'm still catching up. Like, as much as we've done a bunch of stuff, I'm still catching up and like proving to myself and to everyone that like,
of course,
we're legit and we can do it. And some of my partners are some of the biggest players in the city or in North America. Mm-hmm. Like, so to show them now, you've been investing in me and we're as big as you guys now, right? Wow, we have as many projects, they're as big as you and we're executing well. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm not like the little cousin anymore.
Yes.
Like, I think that's the goal.
Are you going to stay in Toronto?
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, who knows what other thing we do as we think bigger, but I love Toronto. I really believe in Toronto and yeah.
What do you think about like just more in, like in terms of the market itself? Where do you see the developments in Toronto going in the next, let's say, three to 5 years?
I think in the next year we're going to see a lot of companies wash out. Okay. A lot of people jump into development. There's going to be a lot of companies that wash out.
Wash out,
go bankrupt. Okay. Like, you know, a lot of projects sort of disappear. But okay. I really believe in the city long term. Like, this is all the boring stuff, but we have less houses than any other major city in the G7. It's a great place to be. Like, the world's fucked, right? Like, you see what's going on? The world's fucked.
Yeah.
No, like,
yeah.
Toronto's a good place to be.
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
And I think we're going to keep seeing people come here and we're going to keep building. It's just there needs to be a bit of a revolution in terms of how we do things and an acceptance that, like, condos aren't, like, some widget. And we make them different. We make them special the same way we would, like, a custom home.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to see a lot of stuff happen in Toronto. And I feel really good about the market long term.
Yeah.
And I feel good, you know, giving a plug to my partners that I have the right partners that we have the staying power. Like, I knew getting into this business as a guy who really just had the sweat, if things go bad, like, I'm not going to have the control that I want to have myself to say, well, we're just going to stay.
True.
So I went out and found partners that are incredible, that get it, see the market, have the capital.
Okay.
And we're going to be able to ride out, you know, whatever the storm is.
Yeah. I want to speak to your partner, your wife, and the role that she plays in you being successful.
You want to call her?
Yeah, we could. Yeah. I mean, the thing is I've noticed that the most successful people that we've interviewed have all, you know, put such a big shine, such a big light on their partner, mm-hmm. And how important they were, because with the days that you have and the long hours and the stress and all these different things, like to not have somebody next to you who's able to kind of guide you through sort of shitty days. I think it's tough. We're on different sides.
He's in the relationship. I'm the single guy.
We're on different sides of that spectrum, but you have to agree.
I don't have to agree with anything.
The most successful guys that we've spoken to have made a very big point without us usually asking, like, I wouldn't be here without my partner.
Let me think about it and get back to you.
Yeah, listen, I'll say this. Like, would I have, without having my wife and without having kids, be where I am in business? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. She's motivated me a lot. She's incredible. I think the way everyone said their wife's incredible, you know, picking up the slack when you're gone. But I'll tell you what she's really done for me then. This is why I am where I am. She's kept me humble and kept me real. There's no bullshit at home of like, oh, you have this big job, so like you're off. She's like, you're fucking out with boss. The kids. Yeah. Like, yeah, let's go. I've been on all day. Like, she's kept me real with the kids and the family and like made me a humble, real person where I think without her, I could have gotten this big fucking head and like thought I was the man. And and she's really kept me real.
My girl, it's the same for me, my girl. She's like, yeah, relax, buddy. Calm down a second. You're still this guy. Like, don't. And
see, my mom just tells me that.
No, which is good. And listen. Obviously, you want a partner who lifts you up and says, oh, you are that guy. But there's some days that you need to be humbled. It just is what it is. And I don't think you can get to certain levels without being humbled.
Bro, I'll humble you any day you want.
I know. And listen, give me a call. No, but hold on. There's a difference. I will say there's a difference from your boys, your buddies humbling you in comparison to like the person that you.
Well, you have a different relationship with her, right?
Like your boys are just giving you shit, right? Because they don't want to tell you how good you are. Your wife like believes that, right? She puts me up on that pedestal, but she also makes it real. And she's like, don't think you're getting out of this shit. Like you're a real human. And like, this is why you're here, right? Yes. You're here for the family. You're here for your kids. Like you're here to be a good person.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like it's great. Go make money. But like, that's not what you're here for. And like that just helps you create that. You were saying that balance, like, right? To have balance, you have to know that things are equally important, right?
True.
When something's not as important to you, it's just not going to get balanced. You're going to throw it aside.
Yeah.
True.
Like she makes me realize how important the other stuff is. And
keeps you grounded.
Totally.
I'm getting 2-on-1 right now.
Yeah, buddy. What happened?
You should be married tomorrow. What pod did this turn into?
It's relationship advice.
If you ever create a condo in Miami and you need a face.
You're the face?
I got you. I got you. Scotty Barnes, I'm taking notes. All right. We're going to do a little rapid fire.
Cool.
And we got our famous question.
Yeah, of course.
All right. Okay. One trait you wish you had at an earlier age.
It's a hard one. I don't know how much I've changed. I know this is a rapid fire question. Like
it's okay. We say rapid fire, but take your time. You can answer.
I don't know, man. I wish I was better at dealing with that. Like today, and I'm getting better at it, that guilt of like being in the moment.
True.
I wish I was always able to be in the moment more. I'm getting better at it.
I feel like you're in the moment right now.
I am.
You're getting good.
What's a piece of advice you'd give to your 18-year-old self?
I think I'd tell myself to go to less school. I'm like, I went to school for too long. Like, I did not need it.
I love that.
Yeah, love that answer.
I love that. Fame or money?
Money.
Yeah. Nice. Crypto or real estate?
I'm in both, but I'm real estate.
Like, you're a crypto guy, though? Yeah, you're a crypto guy?
Yeah. Cool. I want to control my own destiny.
Yeah, fair. Real
estate. Fair. But then you have the dreams on the side. The Bitcoin, the Bitcoin dreams.
That's my guilt. That's the FOMO. I'm like, what if it blows up?
There you go. True or false? Your net worth is your network.
False.
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 Wow.
False.
Tell us more.
False. Listen, I think that it's really important to have that strong network, but no, it's you. You can't just sit there saying like, I got a big Rolodex, so like I'm the man. It's the work. Okay. And I've seen that with everybody. I see lots of guys who have a great network show up asking for money and get rejected.
True.
And you have guys who no one knows that you just believe in.
Well, I guess you've seen it in a different light. Like you've seen people try and use it.
I've seen these rich kids that like,
Look,
you know who my daddy is, and it doesn't get them anywhere.
True. Yeah. Okay.
Damn, you're the first person that's ever said that. I like that. No, I like that. Okay. Biggest red flag in a development.
Site? Like big?
Sure.
Like let's say you're looking to buy actually from a developer.
Oh, from a developer.
Yeah.
Not having their own skin in the game. Like there's guys in Toronto and you can find out who they are pretty quick that own very little of their development and they're in it to make fees. Like, you want someone who like has to live or die by this. Like,
I like that. Retire early or do something you love forever.
Forever.
I think you're
forever.
Yeah. You're gonna do this forever.
I'm gonna do this forever.
Okay. You don't seem to have many or any, but biggest regret in life.
I have no regrets.
Yes.
No regrets.
That's why you got that smile on your face. Look at this guy's smile. He hasn't not smiled the whole time.
I've made a lot of mistakes. I have no regrets.
I like that. Okay. Well, with that being said, then, obviously, we are the MBH podcast. Money buys happiness. So, Adam, I want to know if you believe money buys happiness.
Money buys freedom. Freedom buys happiness. But I think where this question gets fucked up is I think fame makes people really unhappy sometimes. Mm-hmm. So if you just straight up have money, I think you're happy.
Hell yeah. I agree. That's the job. I honestly agree with that 100%. It's definitely the freedom aspect, but the fame can kind of, it draws a weird line there. So as long as you got a couple billions in the bank account or just in equity, we're good to go.
Guys, if you're looking to learn more about development, follow our guy right here. We're going to have all his links below.
Yes.
If you're looking to throw down some cash on the development we're doing in Miami with my face, call me. We're taking all checks right now. No, but for real, hit him up and talk about any sort of, I guess, investment opportunities.
Yeah.
If you guys are interested. Yeah. And we appreciate you, man. Thank you for having us today.
Thank you guys. This was awesome.
Congrats on all the success.
Yeah, keep killing it, bro. Looking forward to seeing more projects.
Cheers. With your face on them.
There you go. Jay?